This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most brilliant weapons designers of our time was perhaps also one of the most amoral. Gerald Bull is best known as the inventor of the supergun, an artillery system with the potential of firing shells thousands of miles. When Bull was assassinated in 1990, he was creating superguns for Iraq. Bull was an independent weapons designer and manufacturer who was also brilliant at exploiting arms control loopholes. He helped build the arms industries of Iraq, China, Israel, Chile, and South Africa. My guest James Adams has written a new book about Bull called Bullseye. Adams is the former defense correspondent for the London Sunday Times and is now the paper's Washington correspondent. One of his previous books was about arms merchants. Adams joined us several times during the Gulf War to discuss military operations. He told me Gerald Bull got his start doing legitimate research for Canada and the United States, not in weapons specifically, but for the high-altitude research project, a venture called HARP.
Bull was obsessed from a very early age until his death with the idea of putting satellites into space or other vehicles into space through the barrel of a gun. Now, he believed that you could actually do this very cheaply. You could do it for a fraction of the cost that it was being spent on rockets, which at that time was the focus of certainly the U.S. effort. And he got funding from the Army, from the U.S. Army, who were concerned that the Air Force were hogging all the action in space, and some funding from the Canadian government, and proved that this system worked. He set up a testing ground in the Caribbean. And he proved that the system worked. He threw things very high into space using old naval guns supplied by the U.S. Navy. And it was quite a successful project, but he was a difficult guy, and he upset lots of people. Like some scientists, he couldn't bear fools, and he couldn't stand the bureaucrats, and you have to tolerate both if you're going to survive in the military environment, which is full of both. So the project went wrong in the end. It ran out of money, it ran out of support, and it was complicated because the Army were only allowed to spend money on things that went a certain amount into space, and the Air Force went, if it went above 50,000 feet, then that was the Air Force's responsibility. Well, Bull was too successful for his own good, and the Air Force lobbied against him, and the project was scrapped.
After Canada and the United States no longer wanted him to work for them, he basically went into business for himself, started designing weapons independently for countries, and some of the countries he designed weapons for were countries that the United States and Canada had weapons bans against.
That's true. It was a very strange process, really, because once the HARP project had bitten the dust, he had to find a way. By this time, he had bought and had legally established this extraordinary complex on the borders of Canada and the United States, where he actually had a factory and a testing ground that straddled the border. So he was able to say, if Canada had a different export law, he was able to say, well, actually, this bit was made in Canada, and if it benefited by being in the U.S., he was able to say the same. And this was tolerated by both sides because it was a sort of convenience, although I've never heard of anything like it before or since. So once HARP had gone, he then had to look at other ways of keeping these projects and keeping his employees in funds. And what he'd been doing with HARP was testing explosives and testing propellants and testing the design of things that fly through the air. And that is, of course, all to do with shells, as well as in what he was trying to do, which was satellites. So he was able to parlay that expertise and put it back into more basic stuff, which was designing shells and designing the guns to fire them. Well, that was cutting-edge stuff at the time, and he came to the attention of a number of people, the Israelis being one, the Belgians being another, and most importantly, perhaps, the South Africans being the third. And at that time, as you say, there was a United Nations arms embargo against South Africa, but they needed to find the weapons that they wanted, and their eyes fell upon Gerry Bull.
Well, in 1980, Bull served a six-month sentence in the United States for smuggling arms to South Africa. What were the charges exactly?
Well, after a very long investigation, the U.S. Customs decided that Bull had sent abroad shells, radar detection vans, some radar systems, and gun barrels, as well as the designs for the equipment. He wasn't charged with all those offenses. There was a plea bargain arrangement, and the charges were reduced. He was very surprised to be convicted at all. In fact, he, to the day he died, he was fighting to get a presidential pardon because he believed that all along he had been acting on behalf of the United States government and that he had full permission to export all of the things that were exported. And he felt that he had been very unfairly treated. And there was a lot of merit to that, actually. There was no question that officials in the U.S. government and in U.S. intelligence knew about what was going on. Whether they actively encouraged it or merely stood on the sidelines is difficult to say. But it was right that he should have got the impression that there was official recognition of what was going on. But again, I don't think he really understood the politics of the situation and became a victim.
Do you think American intelligence was being hypocritical?
I think it was expedient at the time for elements of the U.S. government, as has happened so often in the past and in more recent times, to allow an individual arms dealer to supply urgently needed equipment to South Africa, a country that the United States was supporting as a bastion against communist infiltration from both Mozambique and Angola. So there was a confluence, if you like, or a utility of interests where both sides, Bull wanted to make money and sell his weapons. The United States government wanted to see the South African government get the weapons that it wanted. So I think everybody, so often in these things, it's kind of, well, give him a hand sort of thing, rather than it being written down in policy. And there is no doubt the CIA was involved how much is difficult to say. There's no doubt that senior government officials knew what was going on. But again, whether it was actual policy or people just saying, well, this seems like a pretty good idea, let's worry about the legalities of it later, is much more difficult to say. But Bull was the fall guy, and he paid a high price.
So after his imprisonment, he went into self-exile in Belgium and started working out of there.
That's right. I think he clearly, it's clear from his writings and from what he said to his family and so on, it's clear that he became very disenchanted. He had left Canada, the country of his birth. He'd gone to the United States, the country of adoption. He'd been made a U.S. citizen. He was, by a special act of Congress, he was very, as he saw it, loyal to the United States, and they'd turned around and stuck him in jail for something that he thought was an officially approved project. So he felt that he had no life left in the U.S., that it was all over. And while he was in jail, he'd received a letter from the Chinese government that said, "Dear Dr. Bull, we hear you're having a spot of bother at the moment. Don't worry. We think you're marvelous. We value people of your talent. Come and see us." And he got out of jail, and they paid for him to go to Beijing. And he got a wonderful reception. They greeted him warmly, both he and his wife. They sent him around the country. He was lauded wherever he went. And he decided that these were the kinds of people that he could do business with. And so he up sticks and set up shop in Brussels.
Most countries have some kind of restrictions or regulations on arms trade. Are there any international regulations governing an individual like Gerald Bull, who has the know-how to design arms and manufacture them?
No. And if you think about it, it would be very difficult to have any, because in Bull's case, you have a guy with a U.S. passport. He's living in Brussels. He flies to Beijing. Well, why are you going to Beijing, Mr. Bull? Well, I'm just going to walk along the Great Wall of China, actually. And how can anybody prove otherwise? So it's extremely difficult to control somebody's mind and their knowledge. It's very relatively easy to control product, but not the individual. And nobody has attempted to do that, in part because, of course, it's such a rare issue. You don't confront this very often, and that's why Bull, in an extraordinary way, was so successful, proliferating arms wherever he stopped. And you go around the country today and you look at all those arms manufacturers, third world arms manufacturers that are doing reasonably good business, and you look at Chile, South Africa, Israel, China, Yugoslavia, there, and Austria. There are all those countries, a Jerry Bull, and that's a pretty good effort, really.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Adams, author of a new book called Bullseye, The Assassination and Life of Supergun Inventor Gerald Bull. Adams is a former defense correspondent for the London Sunday Times, now their Washington bureau chief. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. James Adams is my guest, and we're talking about his new book about arms designer and manufacturer Gerald Bull, who was assassinated a couple of years ago. We saw the results of some of Gerald Bull's work in the Gulf War. How did he get involved with Saddam Hussein?
Well, the Iraqis were very keen on, as we all know now, on developing an indigenous arms industry. And Bull was approached by the Iraqi government and offered two things. One, they wanted him to design new and better artillery systems. And two, and more importantly for Bull, they said, well, we know all about this project you did years ago called HAARP, which involved trying to send satellites into space. Well, we're really keen on that also. And we have the money, you have the knowledge, let's get together and you can realize your dream with us. Well, this was a very seductive offer, and Bull took it up. His designs were also bought by the Iraqis from the Yugoslavs and the Austrians, and he, in his own way, significantly helped Saddam Hussein's conventional military capability. And he also designed and built for them these enormous superguns, which we now know about.
Well, the supergun was really one of his ultimate goals, a gun that could fire, what, 1,000 miles?
Mm, yeah, or further. I mean, it was there was no real limit. He would say that actually you could use a supergun in outside of Baghdad to fire at the United States, because really you're sending it out into space. So what the shell on the gun is an intercontinental ballistic missile, but you're firing it from a gun and it's not a rocket. But the shells themselves were rocket-assisted, so you were really only limited by the imagination. If one accepted that the guns could actually work in the way that he said, and if they were designed as guns. Now, his family would say that actually they were really designed as satellite launchers and they weren't supposed to be guns at all. There were papers found on his body that there is no doubt they talked about, written in his own hand, talking about improving the lethality of the system. So he saw them as a lethal weapon, not as some kind of peaceful research that the benign Saddam Hussein was pursuing for reasons of his own.
Bull was assassinated before the supergun was actually created, before the ultimate supergun was created. How do you think it would have changed warfare and would have changed the balance of power if he had lived to finish it?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer, because we don't know still, and nobody knows, actually, how Saddam Hussein intended to use these weapons. Because if you can imagine this enormous gun with a barrel several hundred feet long, firing several Volkswagens hundreds of miles, well, what exactly would he use that for? The noise and the signature of the weapon would be picked up by satellites immediately. Aerial surveillance would detect it. You could only fire one of these things every few hours because they're so difficult to load and fire. So you wouldn't get many shots off. there'd be no opportunity for ranging shots as with a normal artillery system. So you'd have to be looking at firing a nuclear weapon or a chemical device where you'd be looking at very blanket coverage. And you'd probably only get one shot. You might get two, you might get three, but you wouldn't get that many. So the threat of it would have been substantial. For Israel, for example, it would have been very serious indeed. They would have been well within range. Most of Europe would have been comfortably within range. So for somebody like Saddam Hussein, who is ruthless enough to use anything that he has in his rucksack, it would have been very serious indeed. And we don't know how serious, because would he have put a nuclear device on in the weapon? Would he have just used chemical weapons? Would he have used biological weapons? We don't know. Assuming the worst, and it was a nuclear device, it would have significantly altered the balance of power, very significantly.
One of the things you investigated for your new book is who assassinated Gerald Ball and why did they do it. So what do you believe now?
Well, I believe that the Israelis did it because they have a history of killing people that killing individuals who they think are integral to a weapons program of a nation that they consider a threat. So they've killed Egyptians, Iranians, others who Iraqis indeed, who have posed, they believe, play a critical role in a particular weapons program, and their death sets back that program a long way. Now, Jerry Ball was critical to the supergun program. Without him, it ground to a halt. So the Israelis are the logical suspects. The family believe that the American CIA killed him, and others, other businessmen who did business with Jerry Ball, believe that the British Secret Intelligence Service, or MI6, killed him.
Do you think that we're going to be seeing more Gerald Balls in the future, more independent arms designers like him?
Well, I think there has been an evolution in the arms business in recent years, in that you've seen a number of new countries, not necessarily new individuals, but new countries emerge as arms producers. We've seen recently in North Korea selling anything to anyone, China the same. Singapore is an arms producer now, Brazil, major arms producer, Chile, all these countries which 15 years ago weren't even in the frame. So you've got not necessarily the individual like Gerald Ball, but you've got the arms industries that Jerry Ball helped set up and others as well, which means these countries who perhaps don't have the same sort of standards as we might are prepared to sell whatever they make to whoever's got the cash to pay. And that's the problem for the future, how to deal with those manufacturers.
So one of the things Gerald Ball did is help other countries create arms industries, not just give them weapons.
Absolutely. I mean, before Ball gave South Africa the G5 howitzer with his special ammunition, which now the South Africans have exported all over the world, the South African arms industry was insignificant. They're now in the top 10 arms exporters in the world. And Yugoslavia, the same thing. Spain, similarly. Chile, the same thing, and so on. So where you have somebody who gives a country an innovative product, they can use that as the lever to develop a more broadly based industry. And that was the significance of Bull, that he was really very clever at what he did. And he gave these fledgling arms exporters a significant leg up in the marketplace, which gave them a place at the table and an opportunity to earn foreign exchange.
In investigating Gerald Ball and his work, what did you find out about his personality? What kind of guy was he?
He was a funny, warm, loyal, innocent, I would think. He, in so many ways, was the archetypal brilliant scientist, incredibly impatient with fools, very witty, drank a lot, exceptionally loyal to the people who worked for him, continued to pay their salaries out of his own pocket when the company was bankrupt, loved being with his family, very strong family loyalties, brought his children up with in a very good way, and all his family are sensible, intelligent, sober people, if you like. So the sort of guy that you could actually warm to.
How are you innocent and amoral at the same time?
Well, I think, you see, they often can go hand in hand, because if you don't actually, when you go and sell a gun, and if you go along and you say, look, this gun is absolutely fantastic. It fires this wonderful silver bullet that works in this way. And your obsession is not with the fact that somebody's brains are going to be on the floor as the result of what this gun does, but with the performance of the product. He wasn't interested in killing people. In fact, he was actually rather opposed to that sort of thing, believe it or not. And he believed he was working for peace, not war, because people often convince themselves of that kind of thing when they're in that business. But
he kind of believed in deterrence. Good weapons help deter war.
Yes, he did. And so he had no interest really in the end game. He wanted to be loved. He wanted people to admire him for his brilliance. So if the South Africans came up to him and said, Jerry Bull, you are the most brilliant man in the world today, sell us a gun, he'd say, absolutely, I know I'm brilliant. Thank you very much for reminding me of that. And so he was very innocent in that way and very amoral at the same time, because the morality of should I sell this weapon to this person or this weapon to that person never really entered into it. I mean, for example, he was very anti-communist, very opposed to communism, and yet there he was in China, because he convinced himself that the Chinese weren't really communist. They were sort of okay because they liked him. Therefore, they had to be okay. Well, he was just sort of stupid, really. He didn't understand how the world works. He just wanted to make great weapons, and he did.
James Adams, his new book is Bullseye, The Assassination and Life of Supergun Inventor Gerald Bull. Adams is Washington Bureau Chief of the London Sunday Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.